Morning. It's great to see all of you here this morning. I haven't sat on the front row in a little while, and so the singing's a little different down here. It sounds a lot better. Not that it doesn't sound good sitting by Madeline, but it sounds great. And it's been an encouraging morning so far. If you would turn in your Bibles over to Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14. Last year, or last week, rather, Bill talked to us about, and at least he brought up an argument from C.S. Lewis, an argument for faith, an argument for deism, faith in a God. And that argument is called argument for desires, right? Something like from desires, an argument from desire. And the idea is that our desires and our needs, they point to something. A fulfillment for that need existing. So, for example, when I'm hungry, right, I'm hungry because I haven't eaten in a while, but in essence, I'm hungry because food exists and I haven't had some in a while. And when I'm thirsty, right, I'm thirsty because I haven't had anything to drink in a while, but in essence, I'm thirsty because water exists and I haven't had any in a while. And every need that we have, every desire, there's something to fulfill it, right? And so the question is, and the argument comes, when we get to these other universal needs and desires that we have, the need for awe, need for morality, for meaning in this life, and a life that extends beyond this one, or the need for justice, there must be some sort of fulfillment for that as well. So last week, Bill talked to us about where we go to have these particular needs met. That Jesus is the answer for all of these needs. Needs for awe and morality and meaning, eternal life, justice, all of those. And he brought up other examples. And so this week, what we're going to focus on is when people, because we're close to Christ, when people come through our doors with these kinds of desires, and these kinds of needs, when people come through our door with these kinds of needs, how do we minister to them? What do we do for them? How do we minister to people who are hungry for this kind of thing? That's the idea. Teachers and students, you know what I'm about to say? My dad mentioned it earlier. I'm not sure if you've been to Walmart recently, but it's coming. School's coming. It's on its way. And for some of you, when I say that, It invokes various reactions. Some of you are really happy when I say that. Parents are really happy and pumped up. Students, maybe not so much. Teachers, maybe even less so, right? But if there's one thing that the school year approaching means for Watermill, it's that we are about to enter into a season of opportunity to minister to a group of young people moving in this area, moving into this area to come to college. Young people with these kinds of needs. Young people searching for the Christ that we search for, that we serve and that we have here in this building with us. And so we thought it would be a good idea this morning to talk a little bit about that. How do we go about ministering to these people? And before we do so, I'd like to start with a story. Matthew chapter 14, we're going to start in verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He's been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him." For Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to him, "It's not lawful for you to have her." And though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people, because they held him to be a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod, so that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. And prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter." And the king was sorry, but because of his oath and his guests, he commanded it to be given. He sent and he had John beheaded in prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And the disciples came, his disciples came, and took the body and buried it. And they went and told Jesus. Now, when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place to be by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. And when he went ashore, he saw great crowds, and he had compassion on them, and he healed their sick. Now, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish." And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. And then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowds, and they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. Okay, the feeding of the 5,000. It's a familiar story. You've heard it. You've grown up with it. You've seen the flannel graph version of this story, with flannel graph Jesus feeding 5,000 people. We know it. In fact, it may have been superfluous for me to read it, because we all know this story. But I think, just like any other biblical story, when we pause and take a second and really think about what's going on here, to view the characters in the story as real people and not just great big biblical figures, and when we think about that, I think what we find here is something really, really interesting and beautiful. We find that this story happens at an incredible intersection between two different groups of people. And there's something to be learned here. And so we're going to do that. Before we move on, we're going to kind of point out the two groups of people and try to step into their world for a minute. So first of all, our first group, we have the apostles. So we have the apostles. Now, if we take this paragraph, and we just kind of pull it out, like we normally do, and read it, we see the apostles just kind of standing around, waiting for people to show up and get fed. But that's not what they're doing. The apostles aren't waiting around in the desert for people to show up and for them to feed them. No, there are 4 accounts of this story. And in Matthew and Mark, they both follow the story of the death of John the Baptist. But when we read the story in Mark, Mark inserts another smaller story in between them. He inserts different information that gives us an idea about where the apostles are coming from. So in Mark chapter 6, we see Jesus, he gathers his apostles to himself, and he sends them out. He's going to send them out, because Jesus can't be in all places at one time, and he has a lot to accomplish in his short time as a minister. And so he gets his group together, and he sets them up in groups of 2, and he sends them into the different cities to go preach the gospel. And so they do that. He gives them powers to be able to heal people, to be able to cast out demons, and he says, "Go and spread the good news, right? That the kingdom of heaven is here, right? That it's coming, the Messiah is here." And so they go and do that. And then they come back after a time, in around the time that people are hearing about John the Baptist, and they come back to Jesus, and they are just on top of the world. Because this time that they've spent out ministering to people, spreading the gospel, it's been successful. People have been receptive to the message. And not only have they been receptive to the message, but the apostles have healed people. And they've been casting out demons, right? And they're spreading the gospel, and it's so good. Right? And so they come back, and they're experiencing a successful ministry. And not only that, but Jesus sent them out without money, without a change of clothes, without any food, or without a place to stay. And so you think about it, not only are these apostles going out into their ministry field, going out into the cities and ministering and spreading the gospel and having it be successful, and they're experiencing that, but also they're experiencing the feeling of God providing. Right? They can feel God providing for them because they've gone out with nothing, but here they are coming back to Jesus, reporting that all these great and good and wonderful things are happening, that the mission went really well. Right? They're on a spiritual high. Right? Everything's looking up for the apostles. And they come back to Jesus, and Jesus says, you need to rest. Let's go and let's go to a desolate place. And so we're gonna put a pin in them for just a second, and we'll return to them. Now, the second group of people we have here, apart from Jesus, is the crowd. Now, the crowd, they're not all probably close followers of John the Baptist, although I imagine some of them were, because John the Baptist, he was a prophet and a teacher in this time, and John the Baptist had a following of his own, and he was pointing to Jesus and preparing the way. And so we have possibly a group in this crowd who are followers of John the Baptist, maybe close followers. And they know him. They're close to him. And then we have other groups in the crowd who maybe they used to follow John, like some of Jesus' apostles, where they followed John and then they started following Jesus. But no matter how you draw it, how you divide it up, this is a crowd that knows who John the Baptist is, right? And not only do they know them, but they know him. Right? He's been around. He's probably baptized quite a few of them, and they know about his ministry. Right? They know him as a friend. Right? And so imagine, let's step into their world for just a second. You're in ancient Palestine, and this prophet, John the Baptist, starts up his preaching and things like that. And he's preaching a message about the kingdom of heaven being here, and how he's preparing the way, how he's the voice from Isaiah, preparing the way for the Messiah. And it's a wonderful message. It's bringing people hope, and it's successful. He's baptizing people, and good things are happening. And John the Baptist, he isn't just, he doesn't just pull his punches. He's real. He's honest, because he starts calling out corruption and evil in the religious organizations. You see him calling out corruption and evil in the temple and in the synagogues. You remember when a group of Pharisees comes to him, and he calls them the brood of vipers. Right? And not only that, but he's bold enough to call out corruption and evil in the political realm as well. And we see this, it gets messy when he starts doing this with the Herods. So, we have Herod the Great, who dies around when Jesus is very young, and then he splits up his kingdom into his three different sons. And two of his sons, they're in the north. We have Herod Antipas and Philip, his brother. And we hear that Herod Antipas has decided to divorce his wife, who he married for political reasons, and marry his brother Philip's wife, who also happens to be his niece. And John the Baptist doesn't stand for this. He calls it out, and he winds up in prison. And so you're a follower of John, and now John's in prison. And you're thinking, well, something good is about to happen, right? Because this is John the Baptist. This is the person preparing the way for the Messiah. Surely this isn't where the story ends, right? And then you hear about this story at the beginning of chapter 14. You hear about a wild party where the most powerful people are attending. And you hear that John the Baptist is just killed on a whim. And you hear this horrific story about how it happens, how he's beheaded just because, from a promise that was made. And then, what do you do? Right? What are these people feeling and thinking? Right? John the Baptist has just been beheaded. A close friend, at least a religious teacher. And he's just been killed. And so you're sad because you're mourning the loss of your friend and this teacher. But you're also angry, right? You're angry at the Herods. You're angry at the fact that the Romans have had their thumb on you for your whole life. You're angry at the situation. You're also probably starting to get angry at God too, a little bit, because like, where was God when, you know, our friend John the Baptist was beheaded in prison? And where was Jesus, you know, the one who's going around healing and raising people from the dead, when John the Baptist, his friend, was put in prison? And why did he let this happen? And you're confused, and you're hurting, and you're sad, and overall you're just exhausted, right? And your faith gets shaken. And just a side note, it's so notable here. Look in verse 13. And when Jesus heard this, he heard the news. He withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place. But when the crowds heard it, they went to Jesus, right? So these crowds, when they get their faith shaken like this, when they feel not only sad but distraught and angry and upset and confused, even if they're upset with God, they turn immediately to Jesus, right? And that's just a little side note. Think about that. Where do we turn when we feel this way, right? And what happens? The crowds turn to Jesus and they get filled. Now, here's the intersection I was talking about. So here you have people who have just come off of a really successful ministry campaign. They see the hope of this movement. They feel the power, you know, and they feel close to God. Like God's providing for them and taking care of them. And they're seeing progress. And then you have people who are on a spiritual low. People who are not only distressed and distraught and upset, but also angry. And possibly angry at God. And people who are possibly losing their faith. And then you have them meeting right here at Jesus. You have them intersecting here. And what's so powerful and so fascinating about this story is that if Jesus isn't present here, these two groups of people don't intersect at all. Right? And if we're going to be people in this congregation who follow Jesus closely, it'll necessarily mean existing at this intersection between the downtrodden and the hopeful constantly. This difficult intersection to be at. We're at it this morning, and probably every Sunday morning. On any given Sunday, we have people from both groups, people who are hopeful about our ministry here at Watermill, who are seeing good things happening in their lives, they're seeing the progress, and they feel close to God. And then we have people who, through no fault of their own, are experiencing shakiness in their faith, experiencing doubt and anger and sadness and frustration. And you see them meeting here at Jesus. And so the question is, when we meet here, how do we minister in this place well? How do we do it? And for that, we turn back to the apostles. There are three notable things I think that the apostles do here that we can learn from that allows them to successfully minister to these people. So you can imagine this: you're in the boat with Jesus and you're pulling up on shore. And whether you see them first or you hear them first, you see a group of people who are not just strangers, but your relatives, your friends, your neighbors, and they're just completely distressed. And what do? You feel for these people. You're hurting for them. But how do you minister to people like that? How do you help people who are going through this much, who have needs like this? How do you do it? It's a difficult question. But first, what they do, and it's notable, and it kind of flies under the surface here, and I think we only have two of the three, but that's okay. The first thing they do is they welcome the hungry and the hurting. So this one, it doesn't have a verb here. It kind of flies under the radar. But keep in mind that these are the same apostles who in Matthew chapter 18, they send the children away from Jesus, or they try to. right? Because they feel they feel like their master's time is being wasted, or whatever they feel. The point is, these are people who are not afraid to send people away, right? They're prone to do it, maybe. And also, I mean, think about it, because you've had experiences like this in your life, probably. When we interact with people who are going through trauma like this, or have needs like this, or close to us, they're hard to help. And when they show up to us and we're trying to help them, and at first we listen, and then we try to help, but nothing's working, nothing's helping, because how can you help? These people, they start to remind us of our own inadequacies and make us feel inadequate as helpers. Right? And this is a dangerous place to be, because when people that need the most help start to remind you of your inadequacies just because it's difficult to help them, then we maybe start to resent them a little bit as well, too. And then we find ourselves in a situation where we're resenting the people who need the most amount of help. Right? We need to minister to the most. But the apostles, they're able to swallow their pride, and they're able to welcome these people in. And they just bring them to Jesus. They just allow them to come. And I think that's really, really notable. They allow the people to come to Jesus, and they just present him to them and allow him to do the healing, allow him to do the helping. The second thing they do is they take this a step further. They begin to look for and discover needs of these people. So they're not just letting these people come to Jesus and they, you know, kind of put their hands up and back up into the corner and allow Jesus to do all of it. But they really start thinking about the people that they're spending time with. And you get really good at this when you spend as much time with Jesus as they do. You get good at discovering people's needs and meeting them. And that's what they do. They come to Jesus, verse 15. Now it was evening, and the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the day is now over. So send the crowds away to go into the village and buy food for themselves." And Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish." A lot of times we tend to discredit this action by the apostles, I think. And I've done this pretty much every time I've read this story. You see them wanting to send the crowds away, or even in other accounts of the story, like in Mark, you see them say, kind of respond back a little sarcastically maybe with Jesus about, like, "That's a great idea, Jesus. Why don't we feed all these people with all this money that we don't have?" You know, like that kind of thing. We see these comments and them trying to send the people away, and I think we discredit the fact that they actually took the time to see the need, right? That, yeah, they might want to be alone, and they might need time to rest, and it might be an improbable situation, but at the heart of this is the fact that these apostles took the time and the energy to think about what these people need and to try to meet it. And they were just, they're the voice of reason here that says, listen, these people have to eat something. You know, they're exhausted, they've had a long day, and there might not be anything else we can do for them, but they need to eat something. Right? And we can't do that here, Jesus. We don't have enough. We need to send them away. And I think that's really notable. The only problem is that they think that in order for them to meet this need, that they have to send the people away from them. But that's not the way Jesus sees it. And so finally, after they've presented Jesus to the people and allowed them in, welcomed them in, for Jesus to heal them and help them, and after they've taken the time to step outside of themselves and to think about the other people's needs and to present that, they bring what they have to Jesus. So notice, again, down in verse 16, when Jesus says to them, "They need not go away, you give them something to eat." And they say to him, we have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." And then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. And then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men besides women and children. So notice when the apostles come to Jesus and say, listen, there's a need, but we can't meet it. Jesus doesn't rebuke them for not having 5,000 fish and 5,000 loaves. Right? He doesn't say, why didn't you think about this? We should have been ready for these people. He doesn't rebuke them for not having the means to be able to do this. Nor does he agree with them about their solution to just send the people away to be able to take care of themselves. What does he tell them? He says, bring what you have to me, and I'll take care of it. Right. And so the disciples, they bring what little they have to Jesus. Jesus presents what little they brought to him, to the Father, and blesses it. He gives it back to them, and then they use it to feed 5,000 people, besides women and children, to take care of the needs of the people that they're charged to minister to. Now, I want to pause here for just a moment to present our young adult ministry. So as we begin to think about the school year starting and the opportunities that are going to be available to us, I think it's good to kind of get on the same page here and to present this ministry that we have here and what we've been doing maybe for the last year or so. So I was hired as the college young adult minister-ish about a year ago. And if you've been wondering what we've been doing over the last year, this is it. So we changed the name and really the scope of our ministry of this group. So Pathways is Watermill's ministry to, like, out of high school, to, like, married and have kids, kind of. It gets a little messy. But that's just kind of what this area of life is about, your 20s. Because what we noticed is, like, we have Colton, who, he's out of high school, and there he is. Colton's out of high school, but he's not going to college. He's working at MoDOT, which is awesome. You're enjoying it, right, Colton? Yeah, it's great. And then we have people who are Colton's same age and in the same sort of life circumstances, but they're out of the house and living on their own and going to college. Or maybe they're in college and they're married, or maybe they're out of college and not married, or in college or out of college and married, or out of college and married and have kids. And there's just all sorts of different, there's no one, I don't know, they're different paths. And the idea behind this ministry is that we come from these different backgrounds and we're in these different life circumstances, but we meet, just like these people do at this intersection, we meet with Jesus. He's sort of the common ground. And we get to be in each other's lives for however long. And we get to be with each other and to be inspired by Jesus together in this little intersection before we go on our way. Now, Madeline and Brooke and I, this last Monday, we sent out 179 letters and flyers to churches in Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Illinois. And the idea behind this was we were just presenting the ministry, telling people that we're here and what we do. And we're not trying to trick people to come to Springfield, otherwise we would have put pictures of cashew chicken and Andes and pineapple whip and stuff on it. But the idea is that in those 179 churches, there is surely one person, at least maybe, who's going to MSU or Evangel or OTC, or they're coming to Springfield for whatever reason. And we want them to know that we're available for them. So, here in a few weeks, whether we have 179 people show up, or whether we have 5,000 people show up, or whether we have one person show up, that will be a success. It'll be a success. And if you're wondering, when these people show up, how do I minister to these groups? What do I have to offer these people? I would just ask you to look at the apostles' example here in this story. I think that Watermill will have a successful college young adult ministry if we are the kinds of people who welcome people in and present Jesus to them to heal them and help them in ways that we can't. If we're the kinds of people who take the time and the energy to lovingly think about these people's needs, and then to bring what little we have to offer to Jesus in prayer, and to say, Jesus, I am an empty nester, or I am a golden major, or I am a high school student, or I am a young family with kids. I'm a young mom, young father, and I don't have that much time or energy or whatever it is, but I have this much. Show me a way that I can use that to minister to these people. And I think that we'll have a successful ministry in as much as we do that. And so I encourage you and beg you to do that with us. Now, as we enter into what is the focal point of every worship service we have, the Lord's Supper, let's think about the crowds here for a second, just for a moment. The crowds, when they're feeling distressed and destroyed and upset and angry and sad, and they need comfort, and they need acceptance and love, and they need answers, they go to a desolate place, and they find a carpenter, and they find comfort there. They go to an unlikely place and find fulfillment and find comfort and find what they're looking for. And just as the crowds do that with Jesus, we do that today. We come here, united by this story, looking for life, looking for fulfillment, looking for meaning, looking for acceptance and forgiveness. And we go to the image of a man writhing in agony on the cross. We go to one of the most unlikely places to look for life, and we find it there, and the God who becomes crucified and dies for his people. And so this morning, if you have a need, know that the ministers, elders, and everybody else here, that we're always here for you, and we ask that you don't hesitate to present that sort of need to us. But let's be thinking about the crucified God as we enter our time of the Lord's Supper.